ready. Let's do this.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Endurance Chat. This is Cookie Monster FL here, an IMSA-only edition of Endurance Chat, and I have Alex with me today. Hi, Alex. How are you doing tonight?
Hello.
Hey, so, like I said, we're going to do IMSA-only today. We have a couple rounds of the IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Championship to go over. We have went through a little bit of Le Mans hangover, so we... Unfortunately, our response time hasn't been perfect on this, but what a two different rounds that we've seen, from the IMSA Championship. I think if we had done a podcast like this before these two rounds, we would have been talking pretty heavily on the DPI dominance this year, and the results from both of these rounds kind of changed that mindset a little bit, and so we'll get into that right now, actually. So, to start off with, we have the third round of the North American Endurance Cup, the 6 hours of the Glen, over at Watkins Glen in New York. And what always seems to be a solid race, maybe not a legendarily fantastic race every single year, almost kind of turned into that this year. We had opening lap incidents. We had overtaking for the lead throughout the entire race. Different chassis kind of showing their strengths throughout the race. Incredible passes, great blocking, just the drive, almost the drivemanship of some of these racers was just on display at Watkins Glen, and it was a great race. So I hope you agree, Alex, because I certainly am painting this in a really good spot.
Yeah, for sure. I think we'll have to see how the rest of the season goes, but I think it wouldn't be a long shot to say that Watkins Glen was the turning point of this whole season, as far as, especially the way that the prototype championship is going. Some of the stuff we saw in the GT classes as well.
Oh, I completely agree. I think prototype, the racing for, especially in the prototype category, I think was the most, I would say, close racing, intense racing that we've seen most of the year. I mean, DPI has gone back and forth at some of these races and really have put on a show. But we've seen just kind of the world-class caliber drivers that are in some of these. I mean, you know, we had United Autosports, who had an insane driver lineup pretty much that they brought here and did very well even in the practice sessions, qualified on pole. And so you got to see more of this international talent pool of drivers being able to show their stuff in some of these international P2s at Watkins Glen, which we didn't really see in a lot of the other rounds. It was really just dominated by the DPI drivers, which, hey, not a bad shake of drivers in themselves, but to see, you know, the Felipe Nasrs getting up there and competing against, just some of the guys at United Autosports, and then you have, you know, the Simpsons and that kind of, those guys at the JDC Miller. And just to kind of see the whole prototype field actually start to race each other for valuable positions throughout the race was really, really refreshing. And I think it's just kind of one of those glimpses. We saw that last year, too, especially at Laguna Seca when VFR won it, when you're like, man, if they can nail this, this is exactly what we want to see. We want to see these guys being able to show up on a weekend and just nail something where they get a little bit more, get a little bit extra over those DPIs. And I thought... And we'll just get into the prototype category. It ended up being won by the P2. We have an international P2 winner finally in 2018. It was the 99 Red Dragon Gainsco Oreca from JDC Miller, taking the win basically in the last fleeting minutes of the race, going from third to first. What a basically hero stint and pass that was done by Steven Simpson to go on the inside of... I believe it was Romain Dumas and Juan Pablo Montoya who were battling for the lead at the time, heading on the backstretch, heading down to the bus stop, and just had such a toe, and basically just overtook them on the backstretch for what I would say is the VFR Laguna Seca pass of last year is probably the pass of this year so far. Would you agree?
Yeah, that was a really stunning pass to see. I remember as it was happening, I was almost certain that there was going to be some kind of contact or something bad was going to happen, but he just surged right through and took the lead in those two or three corners. And as you were alluding to earlier with the drivemanship of that we saw during this race, I think this track really helped some of the drivers shine and really helped them show what they're capable of. And that's the perfect example of that, I think.
Oh, yeah. And for clarification, it was number 10 versus the number 6. So it was the Cadillac versus the Penske Acura that were going, for, I think, for the lead, and then that was where the exchange happened. So it wasn't the 54, but to further enhance my point, if you look at the final results, so we'll just go through the top. We'll go through the top eight, right? So the top eight. So the number 99 International P2 wins it with Steven Simpson. Great overtake, and definitely showed his stuff against what is an absolutely fine caliber of drivers. Because honestly, number two is the Core Autosport P2 Oreca. So we have two P2s taking the top two spots, driven by Romain Dumas. So we literally have a Le Mans veteran and who knows the podium at Le Mans. Juan Pablo Montoya. Yeah.
Like, set a Pikes Peak record, right? Like, 2 weeks ago, or
fresh,
something.
Yeah, fresh off a Pikes Peak record. So just the prowess on him is of a huge caliber. Juan Montoya finishing third for the number six Acura. Paul Di Resta in the United Autosports finishing fourth, who arguably could be said they had the race to, you know, be taken away from them, which it was. They had, I think, the right strategy in terms of where they wanted to be in the mid part of the race, and it just kind of went away from them at the back half. But again, another...
They were the ones who got rear-ended, right?
Yes, that was it. Yeah. Yep. So, yeah, there was some slight contact halfway through the race, which kind of upset their apple cart a bit. So, but another world-class driver, Jordan Taylor, a Le Mans class winner, and, you know, Rolex 24 winner, Philippe Albuquerque, Felipe Nasr. I mean, finishing, rounding out into the top seven. I mean, that entire finishing stint of drivers, if we could have that in WC and P1, and we could have the cars as close as they were, the gap between first and, what was it, seventh or eighth was only like 20 seconds. So, yeah. I mean, to have that, you're going to have battles, and you're going to have these drivers show their stuff against each other, and we saw that in spades at Watkins Glen. Beyond that, there's a lot to discuss. Don't win it on the first lap, and we kept seeing that this at Watkins Glen. We saw it at Sebring with some contact between VFR and ESM there, and we saw more contact between the two this at Watkins Glen again, so just a continuation of NAC woes for the first lap for those two.
Yeah, actually, they make that connection at the same two teams that had first lap incidents.
Yeah, so I mean, what's your take on that? I mean, they're both going for room, and you kind of want to leave that space, but you know, at the same time, you got to make it to your first pit stop. I feel like without having the car spun around, right?
Right, and they're both pretty experienced teams who've been doing this for a while, so it's kind of surprising that this would happen twice in the same year. But that's just. I'm just going to chalk it up to like random occurrences.
The only thing I'm going to say too, I mean, the other couple points to say with that is that, I mean, those are a full field of over 50 cars or just under 50 cars, pretty much barreling down in the tightest section of the track in which you don't have any runoff and don't have escape to basically avoid a sideways parked VFR car and an ESM car that's just not going anywhere. So to have, I think the 911 clipped the ESM or something like that too, and it was getting going. But beyond that, there was just no other wrecks or anything like that. And I was expecting like a calamity-esque, almost of like Macau or something like that, where you like track stoppage, because we've seen that before. So to have the rest of the GT field kind of avoid calamity was impressive there too. And I hope that. Because I know we had the CTSC race that happened the day before, and they had a bottleneck up of some cars, which ended up, I don't think, red flagging it. I think they might have red flagged that race, or they went to yellow. But so we've seen some calamity there previously. I hope that corner doesn't get changed or anything like that, because I do like the you know, this is a commitment aspect of that. It's just such a huge commitment, especially when you're taking that right left-hander. So, but again, don't want to see contact on that first lap. So that's that's rather unfortunate for them. But
of that, first section of Watkins Glen is such a roller coaster. Like I played it in a sim for the first time, like a couple weeks before this race, and oh my god, it's so fun.
The compression, it's the compression, and then you have like kind of the throwing of G forces left, right, up, down. It's a stomach turner. So it's
the elevation change too.
Absolutely agreed.
Knowing this was in New York, I didn't think of it as a very hilly track, but it works. Like the way it's designed works with the terrain so well.
Yep, I think it's deceiving too for the features. Road America has this problem too, is that you see the hill and you see kind of, okay, well, you know, they're going uphill. You can notice that, but when you're there, you're going, wow, okay, this is a, you know, there's some degrees to this hill that I didn't associate with the actual broadcast. And I think Road America is super deceiving like that too, because you're like, okay, well, okay, it looks like a gentle hill, but you're like, no, you're climbing. Like, you're going to be climbing up and huffing a bit at the end of it. So, I that's why I love Watkins Glen. I don't have a problem with it ever staying on the NEC calendar. My heart's with Road America, so I wish that would be added somehow, but I think Watkins Glen is a perfect track for these prototypes and great, great multi-class racing. So, and I think you saw that. Again, what a race from that the third round of the NEC championship. So, but I think what we're alluding to at this point is that P2's are a little OP here, I think, and that they the style of the track, sweeping fast corners, smooth track with a repave, really, really does help the P2s, especially just get the, maximize what their package is, which is not optimizing suspension, and is really just focused on efficiency, neutral setup, and just consistency. And I think that's what we really saw out of the international P2s that we couldn't really see from the DPIs because of their nerf. But I don't know. I think you saw the same thing. It definitely did feel like the P2s had a leg up on the DPIs here.
Right, the way that they were able to close up gaps and like pretty effortless overtakes that I remember seeing, especially towards later parts of the race.
Yep.
It almost seemed like they were in two different classes, which I guess is kind of a cliche, but.
Now, the DPIs would have the torqueier engines. I mean, obviously, the Cadillac just having that massive torque engine, in a sense. So, the drive off the slower corners would definitely help them. But, yeah, to your point, going on that backstretch, you know, Simpson wouldn't have had that huge run had they not had just been that much more slippery in the air at top speed, at max V. So, you know, for that end, I think, too, this track favored them to even go from P3 to P1 the last 10 minutes of the race. So that was, I think there's a lot of factors that definitely helped them here. Now, do you think that this is something that's going to extend for the rest of the year? Do you think we've fixed this problem in terms of BOP, or is this just kind of an outlier to the championship?
I'm not, I'll have to remember what the other tracks on the calendar coming up are. The only two I can remember are,
Road America, Laguna Seca, Petit Le Mans. I think we've got
VAR, but that's not prototype.
Not prototype. We've got, I think, right. Another one that I'm forgetting.
Yeah, the only thing I remember are Laguna Seca and VAR. Sorry, and Petit Le Mans.
Sorry. So let me rephrase the question. So, do you think the suspension woe that we've been now pretty much assessing on the P2 teams? Do you think that is fixed, or is not a big of a thing, or is it really down to tracks, and it really will just depend on the type of track that they go to? Because this is now a complete opposite response of what we were thinking should happen. DPI mm-hmm. should still win the race. I mean, P2s have an advantage, but DPI still should win it. So them taking this win, I think, is a departure from that logic, but...
Right. I think it boils down to the track. To me, it felt like a track by track thing, kind of like keeping up with the BOP changes as the new BOP comes out for each race, and then seeing what happens in the race. This definitely seemed like it was something that the track did and not the BOP did. Gotcha. As far as I understand it, with the open suspension design of a DPI that the DPIs have, they kind of have like a bigger. I would think that they would have a bigger window for what tracks they could get their car to, what tracks they could get their car to be well suited to. Mm-hmm. Whereas LMP2s kind of have like a smaller window of type of track that they can get their suspension to work well on.
Yeah, I mean, I really like to think of this too, almost as like, I mean, if you want to relate it to NASCAR, if you're understanding of that, it's a little bit like the Hendrick Motorsports. It's like the Joe Gibbs Racing. You can say Front Row Motorsports and Stewart Haas Racing, where they have the outfits and they have the technical means with their staff and the amount of dollars coming in to actually invest and go, okay, look, we're going to go to Watkins Glen and Infineon or Sears Point once a year, but we're going to stick an X amount of money into researching, hey, how do we get the best setup of this track? Even though we only go there twice a year, or we only do road courses twice a year, whereas some of the smaller teams or like the less funded teams don't have the ability to do that research, to spend that money, to do that setup, work that they need to be as fast as they could be at those two tracks. I would feel that mm-hmm. almost transfers over to the P2 teams, where that just almost in a more general sense of setup stuff, they can't test a bunch of things for a specific track or to improve at a specific thing here, because most of their money is just, hey, let's try to just get the car to get to, you know, where we can move the car into a neutral balance at any track and not necessarily work on improving the car at a specific track, more or less just making it so that it can be balanced and work at any track. And I feel like that's not just the whole reason, but that's a different aspect of like, hey, these DPI teams can absolutely figure out specific, and especially with the work that they're doing in the R&D research aspect, they can absolutely kind of make up for lost ground if they're not doing well at a bumpy track or something like that. They can try to figure that out, whereas I think P2 teams are more kind of capped in terms of what they can kind of control or at least fix. But it's a different argument, and I think it's a argument for how difficult it is to balance the two classes, you know, in theory, what it is, P2s and DPIs in this IMSA prototype category. I think it is really tough, and I think you're just seeing that with how, you know, almost OP all these different cars seem to look at different tracks. And I think you're right, is we almost have to look at the calendar to base how you know different cars are going to do. So, but I think we're right though. It is Road America, Laguna Seca, Mazda Raceway, and Road Atlanta Petit Le Mans, which are the last remaining prototype tracks that we'll be seeing. So, from that end, I definitely see DPIs having a say in a lot of stuff. Petit Le Mans will be different, I think, with that long straight and with the technical aspect of the first like T1 through T6. That will be. That might be P2 territory, but I think Road America and Laguna Seca might see more DPI success. We'll see. We'll see. Yeah. So,
yeah, and Penske did really well at Petit Le Mans last year.
Yeah,
and they just had the stock Orica LMP2 back then.
Yep. No, they were leading for a lot of it, and they came back too after making contact with the GTD car. So yeah, the car has definitely, you know, P2s can definitely race there and be competitive there. So that should be one to look forward to. And VFR won Laguna, so we'll see.
Mm-hmm. You know, it almost makes me curious what would happen if Penske Acura this year ran one Acura DPI and one Orica LMP2. You know, wouldn't that be great? I think we'd have all our questions about LMP2 versus DPI answered if that happened.
Right. I mean, like, from a marketing standpoint, it wouldn't make sense to do it, but I would love to see it. I would literally love to see it. I know we've had a couple other teams that have done something in the past similar to that, where that they've used, I mean, I think they've used an older car, but I thought there was like a team like AAR or something like that. Like Dan Gurney did like a Toyota Eagle Mark II, and then he raced some other car that was in the same livery, but it wasn't the same car. I think it was something like that, like in GTP days. But where a team just ran two different chassis like under the same team. I would love to see it. And that would honestly give us a decent look at, hey, what's the differences between what you can make changes with on a DPI and what you can't with a P2, and see where the strengths and weaknesses are. And honestly, I'm tangenting and ranting a bunch here, but I would love to see IMSA do something like that, where they do their own testing, almost like where Formula One and Pirelli did their own, you know, rubber testing, where they actually legitimately had some data that they could go off and go, okay, hey, look, this is where we're looking at, almost kind of like the electronic BOP process that you have for the GT cars, where they understand the parameters of what they're working with, so they can better make these adjustments. Whereas I feel like IMSA's a lot of times on the back foot going, we're not entirely sure what this is going to do. We're just hoping that this makes a correct change. So I don't know. We'll see.
some of the BOP stuff that's happening in Europe is pretty advanced. Like, I think Blancpain does. Well, I mean, of course, there's a WEC, like, automatic BOP or whatever they call it. And then, isn't there this one series where they have, like, their one neutral driver who tests all the cars and they use that data to BOP them all?
I think so. Is that Kreventic or no? That is, I remember reading this somewhere too. I agree. I think there is something like that, but something to that degree. If this doesn't, you know, if the ship isn't righted, you know, I think by the end of this year, that they don't have some, like, explanation for everybody to go, okay, look, this is, if we're not going to split the class up, or if we are going to continue to make it a unified class where everybody should be able to theoretically have a shot to win every week, here are the changes we need to make this work. But, I mean, like, beyond that, I mean, looking at this, the Penske are absolutely in every single race, I'd say, this year in terms of potentially winning it. So I think they're up to speed. Their wins are going to start coming soon, I have a feeling. Road America could definitely play into their favor, although I think that might be more Cadillac. So that's great to see them. Mazda is just still not able to do much. They had a flip in free practice, too, I think. At Watkins Glen, so that wasn't great for them, but still not just having issues. I think there was a mechanical problem. Who was that? One of the Mazdas had a mechanical issue.
Yeah, probably. I don't remember which one or what reason, but probably.
I think the 55 and 77, I think it might be the 77 that had an issue. Mm-hmm. Or did the 77... Oh, yeah, yeah. Yep, 77 had the issue. Yeah, so, again, just the struggles continue with Team Yost and Mazda. It's almost like that Mazda is just not, doesn't want to be a race car. It just wants to be a showpiece. Doesn't really want to move. Mm-hmm. So the struggles still continue with them. But it's good to see the DPIs all kind of having pace at some point. And the Mazda Yosts do have pace. It's just consistency. So... from your point of view, it can't be bad for the DPIs, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll see if Mazda can make something happen at Laguna Seca again this year. They were really strong there last year.
And the Cadillacs, too. I mean, we had AXR and Wayne Taylor Racing were up there battling at the front as well, so that's not too bad. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
GTLM.
I think we pretty much talked Prototype to death. So, again, to recap, 99, Gainsco, Red Dragon. We didn't even talk about them too much. What a great win for them. This is their first major win coming back from 2014 and having Mamo Gidley pretty much have his legs destroyed from hitting the Rizzi Ferrari at Daytona. So this is a huge, huge win. And I've watched Red Dragon ever since Grand Am. So that car has been in my brain for a long, long time. And it's great to see them in victory lane and to see Bob Stallings a happy guy again. So, otherwise... Great win for them, and P2 seemed to all of a sudden come alive at Watkins Glen, so we'll see for the rest of the championship. GTLM, yeah, so let's talk about that. Went from Prototype, which we had so many storylines, to GTLM not really having a ton. It really looked from the first half of the race like it was going to be a snooze fest, like we were just doing Noah's Ark 2x2x2 almost.
Yeah. I think it was like four sets of two that were all separated by like 4 seconds or so, I think, was what I remember seeing.
Yep.
It was like 4 TTs that were like half a second apart, and then 4 seconds, and then like 2 Corvettes that were like half a second apart, and then 4 seconds and such.
Right.
Because when I saw something like that was when I wrote that snarky Reddit comment about like, oh, GTLM is 3 classes or whatever.
So for instance, at the halfway point, you were dead on. We had the 911, the 912, pretty much 1-2, with a 12-second, with a 1-second gap back to the 66 and 67. Then followed by the 4 and 3, then followed by the 25 with the sister car falling a couple laps down from that time. So yeah, they were just complete lockstep of the class, even through the halfway point. But then at the end, we saw some actual overtaking and some jumbling of manufacturers at the front with the number 66 for Chip Ganassi 4GT Racing Dirk Mueller driven GTLM winning that class, followed by the number 3 Corvette and the 911 Porsche rounding out that podium for GTLM. So ended up turning into a Ford they earned it at the end. They had the track position when it mattered with that late caution, and didn't need to do much outside of just driving a little bit away and defending. But otherwise it was a solid race. It definitely wasn't my favorite GTLM race of the year, though, I would say. How about you, Alex?
I think it was a good race. It was just that there was so much more going on in the other two classes that it was just kind of like pushed off to the side. But I think on its own, it was a solid GTLM battle, though.
A slow burner, let's say. We had a lot of information overload with P and GTD, so a slow burner GTLM didn't really pop up on the radar until kind of the last hour or so when you were kind of going, oh, okay, all right, finally, they're starting to mix up some positions there, so that's good. But
exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, BMW really didn't do much all weekend, all race weekend, it didn't really feel like. Ford were doing well. Porsche, I felt like, had the consistency to win it. They just didn't have, they just didn't have all the cars where they needed to at the end of the race. But it's good to see kind of all of those top three makes kind of vying for position and really, really, really missing Rizzi. So I would really love to see a Ferrari on that timing and scoring screen again. But yeah, like you said, it was a solid race, and it was definitely worthy of, an AEC round, but. Again, mm-hmm. I just think that the camera was really fixed on P and GTD, so didn't get a lot of coverage. So,
yeah. Although I do like mentioning Rizzi, I do think that having them back in there, having the BMWs up with everyone else, would have given it a lot more excitement, though.
Right.
Just, like, kind of seeing the same three cars over and over again is kind of gets a little monotonous, I guess.
Traffic too. The track is very wide sweeping, so you don't have a lot of opportunities to really regain ground or pull away. It's just kind of like, okay, well, there's just kind of a gradual sweeping. Okay, well, you're going to take the inside here. I'll just take a late apex wide entry, tight exit, into a left sweeper or right sweeper that you see at Watkins Glen, where you don't see that at like a CTMP, or something like that, where there's more. You have to commit to almost one line in a corner, and you got to back out and give that person room. Otherwise, you're not going to make it. So I feel like there is a lot less opportunities for people to just naturally make up ground, even in traffic. And just with, this is the lowest NAC round of the year in terms of car count. So there's not as much just physical traffic and roadblocks that you might find normally, even in GTD. So
yeah.
Beyond that, it was just still a great race because you had such great passing in the class. So can't go wrong there, but. Ford with another win. I don't know the actual NAC points spread for GTLM. I know Prototype is kind of its own thing right now, and I think it's a little bit close there, but I think GTLM is closer, but I don't have that point spread right now. I think I think Fords are leading that, though, and looking strong. So interesting to see how they finish the rest of the year up. We'll move on to GTD since, like I said, solid race, but not a whole lot to talk about GTLM. GTD had a lot of talking points, a lot of controversy, a lot of close racing. Overtaking at the end, though, really didn't become a thing, and it really just did become about track position, in which the startling thing, I would say, beyond the whole land controversy, which we'll get into, is if Hawksworth didn't accidentally go through the pits, Alex. He probably would have won.
Yes. It's almost completely certain that he would have won. Stuff like that isn't unheard of. Like, it happens. People make mistakes like that. And we see that in other races sometimes. But for it to happen and cause a loss is something I've never seen before. It's just, I don't know why it's so funny. It's just...
It's like Lexus, too.
I think it's like the mental imagery of him just like trundling down the pit lane at like,
oh, hey guys,
40 miles an hour or whatever, while his team is like, dude, what are you doing?
What are you doing?
And like his name is just like going down the leaderboard.
Yeah. Well, hey, look, I mean, sometimes when you hear that box, I mean, that's the strange part too. I mean, you're supposed to say box in the radio because it's a specific word that is really hard to mix up. It's a lot different than pit. It's like a specific word that you use, and then you go into the pits. So unless he's like thinking like there's a fuel count, but it wasn't even fuel. So unbelievable. This Lexus team, I swear, since like last year, they just have done nothing but shoot themselves in the foot randomly for like reasons that are just unexplainable. Like Scott Pruitt just randomly like. Losing control at Daytona last year and just like smashing into the wall, his last Rolex 24, completely not Scott Pruitt like, and then just having so many driver problems with incidents last year, incidents this year, driver gaffes. Like that Lexus team, I don't understand. Like they should just be locking this up. That car is so fast, but man,
Yeah, it's really frustrating for them.
Well, this means that Catherine Lai now gets a podium because of that. I mean, also because of Lan's issue, which we will get into that. But Leg has to have a full time ride. And honestly, at this point, let's just say it: she does have a full time ride as of this recording. She does have a full time ride for the rest of the year. So it'll be good to see her compete against the Lexus team, pretty much, to see how that goes.
Madison Snow, exactly.
So that'll be a great GTD championship fight all the way to the end, and I'm really glad to see that that's going to extend to the Acura team as well. So another one's lost, another one's fortune, I guess. And so Acura's going to take that, coupled with the land penalty. Now this is there's not a whole lot for me too much to say about it. I mean, it's a penalty that. It was a bang-bang kind of play, you know, if from a football, whatever, sports kind of standpoint. It's really tough to see, in terms of real time. But look, I mean, this is motorsports, and we've got the live timing and technical data to say, hey, look, you were 2 seconds too late to get in the pits. And look, you can't do a full service. You got to do an emergency service. And we're sorry that you didn't realize it, but that's it. Like, I don't. The alternative is, what else are you going to do? Like, I mean, if they were right and they shouldn't have been penalized, how are you going to penalize that in the future? Like, you got to have something, some concrete thing to do. And I just think that it was just super, super unfortunate that it ended up happening that way. And, I don't like their kind of tantrum that they threw over it. But, they were slighted at Daytona that they felt. So this is just another NEC round that they felt that they were slighted, and it's a shame that we're probably not going to see him at Petite, though. So,
I would guess not.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seemed kind of. I wish they came out with some kind of statement or something after the race that, like, some kind of. I wish they explained themselves, basically.
Right.
And I don't think they ever did. So.
No, I don't feel.
It was just like drive the car back to the garage and say goodbye.
Well, they said that they. Well, I had read a couple places that IMSA just told them to park it. So. I don't know if that was IMSA's telling them to park it, or if they
told them to.
Okay, right. So
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so if that's the case, then they would have just parked it. But, I mean, from that aspect, it just looked like they were, like, well, and again, this was said in a couple articles. I think more communication should kind of be brought out to what the deal is from the broadcast crew. Because, I mean, I don't know about the Fox broadcast, but the the IMSA radio had no idea what was going on. And they thought that they were just parking it. They were checking out. They're packing up for the day. So, if IMSA tells you to park it is, I think, a big deal. And it can definitely shape the attitude and opinions of a lot of your viewers, which is where you're getting a lot of the opinions from. So...
Sure.
I think a little bit more clarification from that, more official clarification on some of these penalties should be brought forth, I think, for these next rounds. But
because I was listening to Radio Le Mans, and I thought that they were just
some interesting calls on some pretty controversial things over the last few years that I remember on certain radio stations of some endurance moments that were kind of incorrect. So this is just another one that I'm noting. Not saying anything, not making any comments. I'm not hinting at anything. I'm not implying anything. I'm just saying there are times that there's a little bit of old man syndrome that I think hits. But, this is fine. That's fine. But we'll beyond that, so as the what I would assume are the top of the leaderboard in terms of GTD pace and just the pace setters of the race falling like flies, basically Turner emergence out of nowhere at the end of the race. I mean, I think you were asking this earlier. I mean, were they on any specific strategy in which they actually just showed up, or was it just a good race of positioning for track position that they played, and just how the cards fell, they ended up just inheriting the lead and doing a good job holding it? Is that kind of what happened? Is that a good summation?
Yeah, I'm not sure. They weren't really on my radar the whole race, so I don't know if they like managed to skip a pit stop or just fought their way all the way up there or what. But they were there at the end, and they killed it.
I mean, it's looking at some of this data that I can see, they were in the top five of the class for the back half of the race, pretty much consistently. You know, they were basically P5 all the way up until about an hour or so left to run. And then that's when they started kind of making their moves, essentially when the other competition started getting pinged. There was the change for position, which ended up being the ultimate change for the lead. With, I think, about 40 minutes to go when the 96 did pass the 86, the Acura. So that was four positions. So they put themselves in a spot to win when the 29 eventually had to box and basically retire. So they did do enough to do that. But again, what I love to see at the end of the race is that you've got basically two of the championship contenders right up there on the podium, with the Lexus suffering some issues that they really shouldn't have.
Hey, they were still fourth. That's not
right. Terrible. Right. So that, yeah, at the whole end of the day, they didn't like, yeah, they, it was a missed opportunity, but it really didn't, it wasn't really negative outside of that for them. They managed to recover really quickly. So,
although if they were fourth, imagine how many seconds they would have won the race.
So would you say that the Lexus is the class of the field this year in terms of the chassis right now, how the BOP is working and their setup? That car just seems to be the best outside of maybe the Lambo? Or would you say the Acura? Is it a Lexus, Acura, Lambo deal? Or is it just these teams have just got the driver lineup this year? They've got everything working.
I think Lexus has definitely made big steps over the first year, which I don't remember if it was last year or if it was 2 years ago. But I'm not ready to say that they're the car is definitively above any other TTT car. I feel like there's kind of this clump at the front of the field, which is the Lamborghini, Acura, Lexus, maybe the Mercedes, and then there's like this back half of the TTT field right now for whatever reason, which is the Ferraris and the Porsches, and I guess, well, there's only one BMW this year, so we can't really say anything from that. But
so we don't have any notes. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I was just going to finish up and say I don't think that any one car is like specifically standing out, but I think the Lexus is up there with the other faster GTD cars or the faster GTD teams.
You mentioned the Mercedes. So is there any explanation for the I guess almost like the lack of performance? I mean, it's a GTD, it's everything's BOP'd, and there's a different, you know, there's high caliber of teams. Riley's always been up there, and usually we've always seen him in a podium or something up there. This year, it's been pretty absent. We haven't seen that Mercedes really up at the front at the end of races. I mean, is it just kind of one of those years that they're not going to have the cards together to get in the front at one of these races?
So they haven't really like had any like headline making podiums or anything. But I was looking at the standings, and they're actually pretty far up there. They've been finishing pretty consistently. So
just not grabbing headlines with wins, pretty much.
Right.
Gotcha. So. But yeah, so just a quick rundown too. So pretty much just the end of the race, how we were looking, or kind of what we were talking about before, BMW grabbing the top step with the 96, followed by the Acura number 86, and with that, Catherine Legg keeping her well in the championship hunt there, followed by Paul Miller Racing's Lamborghini number 48, finishing out the podium there. Then yeah, Jack Hawksworth with that Lexus 3GT Racing, P4 with the 15, and then yeah, like we were saying with the Team Riley finishing out P5 with the 33 of that Mercedes. Beyond that, then it's pretty much Park Place Porsche with the best Porsche finish. I'm surprised the 911 GT3s are not really competitive at all this year outside of the two teams. Granted, Wright Motorsports getting that second team and really just kind of being still slightly new to the championship a little bit. But, it's just everybody else is kind of just playing for scraps, I think, beyond that. So,
and on one hand, there is that like 911 GT3 update that's supposed to come next year, like the Evo kit or whatever with improved aerodynamics.
You're right.
But on the other hand, the 488 got that this year, I think, and it does not look like that has helped very much.
No, it's they've looked like they're stuck out in the weeds for a bit so far. So we'll hopefully they start kind of getting it together at the back half of the season here. But hey, look, I mean, there's how many manufacturers and there's how many steps in the podium. So you can't really expect everybody to really get one all the time. So somebody's going to be starving. So we'll see if that changes though in the next couple of rounds. But overall, Watkins Glen. my thoughts, we had a lot of thoughts in this race, but overall, it's my favorite NAC round, I think, so far this year. I'll say Sebring was pretty good. I really like Sebring.
Yeah.
In terms of all the classes, but this one had the last stint pass for the win. That was a great pass, so it's up there. I love this race.
Yeah, that might be the moment of the season. And going back to what I said at the beginning about Watkins Glen possibly being their turning point of the season, not only was like the first LMP2 win and kind of like the first like big coming out for LMP2s, but you could argue that this is where Leggy and Parent got the, like, this performance was potentially what got them the full season.
Yes.
The full season pass, which obviously you can't pin that down to any one specific thing, but I think seeing them do so well here really pushed the needle a little bit on that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think, and with only four more rounds to go and in the championship position that they're in, this is a no-brainer for anybody if they... If they want a quick, hey, back half of an advertisement role at a motorsport team, a racing team that will get coverage because they will be at the top half of that field pretty much every race. I think that's a guarantee now, just looking at the results so far through the season. I think it's a no-brainer for them to at least continue, or at least to be able to flex something and to find some sponsorship to make this work. And I'm glad that they were able to. And again, I think it just speaks for, I think, When and if Michael Shank ever leaves IMSA or leaves Prototype or Sports Car Racing, which he says he never will, and there'll always be something with it, but if that presence ever diminishes to a point where we don't see it as much, again, it's, we're going to owe him a debt of gratitude just for the amount of things in different ways that he's done, either in prototypes, in the GT classes, that he's done to kind of keep the storylines going and keep the racing really, really great and close and giving really good aspects of, you know, a different story than we're used to. And I think, you know, that is a continuation of this year too, because I'm used to seeing him in prototype racing. So to see him kind of going into GT is a quote step down for me, but to see his commitment to Catherine and to kind of keep her going in this championship when they're clearly just excelling right now, it speaks a lot for, you know, his leadership. And I appreciate it as a motorsports fan and a sports car fan. So
yeah, it's clear he's really passionate about the sport, and you can see that with how hard he worked to first get them in NAEC and then manage to like sign that deal with Meyer Shank or whatever else had to happen to get the full season.
Yep.
And even just from like listening to like interviews of him or his listening to like him on watching him on YouTube videos, he's just, you can tell he really loves everything about this.
He's consistent. I mean, he's just he has a passion for motorsport, and he's just stayed with it for so long. I mean, a lot, and that's what I think is so refreshing to see, is that we see so many teams in his kind of aspect where they're doing this not necessarily for fun, but they have a passion for it. But there's a limited amount of passion, and once you kind of burn that up, especially in the sports car realm, it just kind of, you know, it fizzles out, and you end up doing something else. But you know, Michael Shank seems to just have gone all in on the, I'm going to be a owner of a motorsport team, and I'm going to be an owner of a motorsport team until I am super old. Like, and so that is, you know, almost like a Roger Penske, kind of like a Chip Ganassi-esque kind of thing. And it's been refreshing to see that aspect be on the sports car side of things, because I think that is necessary for this championship to continue excelling throughout the next 10 years. Because if we're saying that this is a international world caliber type championship that can compete with the likes of WEC, Blancpain, and all this other stuff, we've got to have these teams that we see in those championships that are going to be here for the next 10 years, that we know are going to be here the next 10 years, and don't have to worry about, hey, do they have funding to even fund one car next year, let alone two? So I think he's a great example of, I think, the kind of ownership I'd like to see from the privateer aspect, or just from a more team ownership standpoint in IMSA. But I am ranting a lot. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that too.
Yeah, going off on Michael Shank, if you have time, look up his YouTube videos. Look up the YouTube video. Type in like Michael Shank Ford DT walkthrough, or like Michael Shank Honda LMP2 walkthrough. It's these videos where he talks about like the, like when they just got the new Honda LMP2, or like when they got the Ford GT, the Ford Daytona prototype, the ones back in like 08 or whatever. He recorded these videos of like him being the team owner, like walking through all the different parts of the car and like talking about all of it. And I feel like from those videos, you really get a sense of what he's all about. He really, you can tell how much he loves the cars and how excited he is to have these cars on track and have them revving their engines and everything.
All right, I'm
adding. That's sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, adding that to my watch list. I definitely haven't seen any of those, so I want to check those out.
Mm-hmm. But yeah. I mean, it's like, they're like not really relevant anymore because they're from like 2012 or like 2008 cars, but it's really, I feel like you almost like learn more about his character than the cars from those.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. And I think it says a ton about, you know, just the commitment that he has to it. Just, you know, from an ownership standpoint, he doesn't need to know any of that stuff, but I think he wants to know it, and he wants to be involved and wants to deliver kind of the best that he can for, you know, his team. And I think that is admirable to say the least. So, but so from the NAEC round at Watkins Glen, the traveling circus of IMSA travels north of the border to Canada to Mosport. I just prefer to call it Mosport because that's one of my favorite tracks. Canadian Tire Motorsports Park, as capitalism would love to interfere. But it's a fast short track. I would almost just say it's the short track for prototype racing. Basically, it takes, 5 to 6 laps for the prototypes to basically get up to the back of the GTD field. Actually, to almost lap the entire GTD field, it takes, mm-hmm. 5 to 6 laps. So,
Laps are, 1 minute, barely more than 1 minute here?
Yes. Extremely quick times. Some of the corners are huge amount of compression in some of the corners. Very low speeds in some, high speeds in others. A very long backstretch. It's just a lot of sweeping corners. It's a rhythm track, and it requires a lot of attention and a lot of precision placement. Nevertheless, having to navigate through traffic, which you will do on a consistent basis for the entire race. We saw for the free practice and qualifying, we saw not necessarily a change of departure, but a continuation of what we saw in Watkins Glen. A Oreca P2 car basically wiping the field. Well, no, sorry. The Ligier was leading everything in practice and qualifying, but another P2, International P2, leading the field in practice and in qualifying heading into the race. This time it was an Oreca chassis, Core Autosport, with Colin Brown just apparently loves CTMP and is apparently just a better driver than everybody else this weekend. This is like, he is just like, for this weekend, was there anybody that could even get close to Colin Brown? Like, he just, every free practice he was fastest. Every qualifying, he was fastest. And for the race, they ended up starting at the back of the prototype field, in which he worked his way through that pretty quickly once he got in the car. So I guess my first question to you, Alex, is look at the prototype field. Was there anybody capable of even challenging Colin Brown this weekend or this past weekend?
From the last restart, I would think no. Once he got into that first place position, he kind of just said goodbye to the rest of the race and just drove off into sunset.
Yep. What a pass before that caution, though, that last caution that was brought up by the Mazda 55. The 54 ends up winning it this week. The 54 ends up winning it. But it was, again, what about that pass that was right before that safety car? I thought at first that the 10 was going to stay in front of the 54 before that green flag was going to come out. But it looks like he had just managed to pass it on the back stretch right before the right-hander.
Yeah, that was a little confusing to me as well. But like seeing the 10 let him back by again and stuff.
Yeah, and just another aspect of where that the Wayne Taylor Racing is there at the end of these races, and they're going to get this win. They've just been, you know, for all the luck they seem to have all of last year, they've had almost none of it this year in terms of just being there when it counts. And I mean, they were there when it counted this this past weekend, but like I said, I don't think anybody could stop Colin Brown. And I mean, it was just even if they were ahead, I think there was enough time for him to have at least 4 to 5 goes at Jordan to try to overtake him and hopefully not make contact. But man, that P2 was quick, and it was quick the entire weekend. Looking at it, so the safety car that we were just talking about was brought up by the Mazda 55 spinning off into the gravel trap at Moss Corner, and another race, another Mazda problem, and they just cannot seem to stop shooting. I don't. Do they have a foot left? I think they've already blown off their foot enough times that I don't think that they have anything left. But
yeah, and when you're going through, when you have a car that's prone to mechanical problems, anytime that you DNF because of track issues, anytime you have mechanical problems, any sort of crash or accident just hurts like two times worse.
Yep.
Because it's like you were already like so unlikely to finish a race, and like now like this other thing also happened, and like now you like really aren't going to finish the race.
They said it was some suspension problem. I think after the race they had said something about that. I haven't seen a confirmation. I read that by one person, but
so it actually was mechanical.
Yeah, so don't. I would definitely put an asterisk on that bit, because I don't remember where I saw it from, and I know I read it. So, but if that's the case, another mechanical woe for them. The sister car does finish, but again, outside of the top five, which I think for Mazda, I don't think it's hard. It's that difficult for me to have an expectation for them to finish to try to finish the top five of each race. They don't even have the podium; just get top five. You should be able to do that, and it's. The struggles continue for them, just finishing slightly outside of that.
And I guess what I was saying earlier was that if you know that your team is prone to mechanical failures, any driver error is just so frustrating.
Yep.
Because it's like we didn't even have a mechanical and we still didn't finish, you know?
Yeah, so it... And looking at... So I'm looking at the rest of the... So we'll just go through the lineup here. So 54 wins with Corrales Sport in the Overeck LMP2. Jordan Taylor, the first of the Cadillac DPIs with Wayne Taylor Racing, finishes P2.
Right there where it matters, like you said.
Yep, exactly. AXR, again, it's just like the Cadillacs seem to just finish in a group and they finish high. And both the AXRs, first from Felipe Nasr in the 31, who I think has fit really, really well into that group and has done a really good job. Basically, both of these team cars... with international P1 or former P1 drivers and F1 test drivers doing really well with the mesh of that talent. Because I feel like both of those teams, they didn't necessarily have international stars, but they had kind of like local international stars. We had more of like South American talent. You had more of like homegrown caliber drivers that were platinum caliber drivers, but you don't have the kind of international flair that you do with some of the actual driver names in here. But again, like I said, Cadillac doing very well, 3-4-5, the 31, or sorry, second, third, fourth, the 10, 31, and 5, running that out. The first of the Acura DPIs, the Penske Acura DPIs by Ricky Taylor, finishing fifth, number seven. What's the deal on their pace? It just seems I feel like they should be able to get a win at some point here, but they have just not. I mean, not necessarily get it. You know, just to have a good performance. I mean, I just feel like they're there. I mean, they almost seem to be more there than a lot of other teams, but then they just fade out completely.
They just kind of drop it. Yeah.
I mean, Mazda has woes, and I know like there's expectations that they're just going to fall off at some point anyway, and it's more just sad when they fall off. But Penske almost. It's almost like a lack of pace in the last two stints or something like that. They can hold the lead and then just lose it and not be anywhere. Right, yeah. So, interesting. Yeah,
I think they were initially ahead of the Cadillacs in the last part of the race, but they just kind of let them by kind of easily. One thing that is important to note, though, is that the number seven was the second running number seven was the second running Acura for most of the race. The number six was the one that was up front, and I think, in the lead for a good chunk of the race. But then they... left the pit stop while the pits were closed, and they got a 60-second penalty or a drive-through penalty or something, and so that was what killed them.
I forgot about that. Yeah, they ended up finishing behind the GTLMs at the end of the race too. Yeah, just suffering still from that penalty. I mean, it's tough to it's tough to recover that anyway, anywhere, especially with the BOP of the prototype class. But at TTMP, when it's just you have no time to do anything and there's no real way to do anything. It's tough to regain any of that lost time. So beyond that,
The Acura pace though, you're right that their pace isn't like as like crushing as I think most people thought it would be when they heard that Penske was coming back.
Oh yeah.
And I think that's just a testament to how competitive the racing is in DPI. Like people always like to compare Penske now to Penske back in like the ALMS, Porsche RS Spyder days, but you have to remember that that's basically two completely different series with almost nothing in common except maybe the tracks.
Mm-hmm. I think it's...
You know, like they were like open cockpit cars back then.
Right.
It was a lot less restrictions and...
I think a lot of people really just kind of feign for that kind of easy... Nah, I wouldn't say easy. I think there's a lot of apprehension too with like the prototype category because it's really tough to gauge like who's what. And I think we're just, I mean, as sports car fans, the history of prototype racing, sports car prototype racing has usually just been the guys that have the best idea usually just win and mop the floor with everybody. And to see kind of these, you know, consistently see, especially in ELMS now for the years, and now to see with this, where you're almost just, you don't know where the pace is going to be a lot of times, and you're just kind of going like, okay, I don't know of anything I can balance anything on. So it's almost just, it's a what happens on Sunday. There's no real prediction outside of, okay, well, does the track set up with the driver set up, with the ambient temperatures, with the conditions, with the, you know, double yellows all factor in for this driver? Okay, then he's going to probably do better. And I think that's been a struggle for a lot of people to get used to, especially the prototype category. I think it's just because, you know, we do look, because that's, I agree with you. I mean, looking at all the winter testing that Penske was doing, I was just kind of watching their videos and looking at the Penske and going, well, they might just break the championship if they're doing enough of this testing and just wipe everybody off the floor, even with BOP. But they haven't really done a whole lot outside of had their own teething issues in this first year, which I'm perfectly happy with, to be honest. So, but I think they'll get it together, and I think if they aren't seen by Petit to be up there and actually fighting at the end of a race, I think Petit will be maybe their breakout and where they might snag something. But man, I mean, you can't really base anything off of the last few years from Petit, and this BOP might be crazy. So we'll see. Right. We'll see. I'm definitely curious as to what's going on with Penske in terms of their pace. I thought they were going to be more consistently faster, but man, hopefully it's just a teething thing and they'll be up front. But the next big thing too, I think, is from this race is Coors' decision to, I think it's the right, I mean, I think ultimately it was the right decision anyway, and I just didn't see why they wouldn't have done this after qualifying. But when Colin Brown put the 54 on pole, they surrendered the pole to basically put John Bennett in. So he could get his drive time stint length in, his minimum requirement in, so then he could jump out and basically let Colin drive for the win if he wanted to. So the 54, which won the pole, ended up starting at the back of the class, in the tail end of the class, and had to power his way through to win it, which he did. So that kind of comes into question why you would even want to do qualifying in the first place if you know that you're going to do a driver change and you're... Your amateur driver is of no ability whatsoever to even remotely qualify the thing in a competitive spot. Is there any reason to put it on pole outside of just to get some sponsorship dollars, just to get your name out there and to get your brand out on another article on SportsCar365 or Racer.com?
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's a really, like you said, the strategy is sound and everything about it makes sense, but it's just really unorthodox, I guess, and it's kind of hard to get used to. It's kind of like a difficult thing to wrap your head around because like we're so used to like qualify and then race and then
that it matters. You know. It's important. Yeah. I mean, it's got to be luck. You got to have some luck with the yellow flags, like you were saying too. Is that yellow flags have to come into this as well? You can't just. It's tough to make up, you know, starting at the back of the prototype field when you've got 10, 11 prototypes. So. You do definitely need stuff to kind of fall in your lap, and it did with Core this weekend.
Yeah, I remember them saying that the first yellow was really well timed for them. So it must have been just past Bennett's minimum drive time.
Yeah, by literally, I think it was a couple minutes when it ended up coming out. So everybody that wanted to swap could, and you saw some of the DPI teams that were in the front that didn't do that, and I think were on a little bit of the back foot by the end of the race, just simply because they didn't want to do that, which is. To me, it's not almost a question of, hey, do we want to do qualifying differently? Because I think that's a good trade-off, and it makes sense. I mean, from a strategy standpoint, you got a guy that is not the fat. He's probably one of the slower guys that's in that class. You want to get him done and dusted as soon as you can because you're going to be at the back of that field whenever he gets out of that car. So you might as well get him out as soon as you can, so you have the least amount of damage that's applied to you for the rest of the race. So it makes sense from that aspect. But almost from that too is that, I mean, a longer race would probably help that too. I mean, you wouldn't need to have John Bennett immediately be in the car and then come out at 20 minutes. If he has to be in that car for 30 minutes, it doesn't make sense for him to maybe, you know, or it might make more sense to start your actual good driver out there to get through to the mid part of the race and then get, you know, give him a break for 20 minutes or so and then put him back in.
Right.
So,
yeah, maybe I think this 2 hour, 40 minute worked really well for this.
It did. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It was like the perfect time length to do this with.
Right. And I think for these race lengths, that is definitely a strategy that you can't be punished for it. I mean, there's just no, I mean, outside of your starting position is surrendered, but this, it makes the most sense in terms of your overall strategy. If you're looking at it from a race aspect, who cares about qualifying? You're looking at it to get the highest finishing place for the race. And if your driver is the caliber of the field, which Colin Brown was, get him in there ASAP and try to minimize damage that Bennett's going to do of the overall stint length or your overall stint time that you lost for the stint for him. So perfect strategy call by Core, and it required some cautions, but they made it work perfectly and just managed to sneak past the 10. So great. Great prototype racing again for the second straight week or for the second straight race for WeatherTech Sports Car Championship. So yeah. I thought it was great. ESM, though, having slight issues even to start the race, they didn't even have their full secondary car. They had to share the lineup. I think it was for the 2 or was it the 22? I think
it was the 22. The 22. The results.
So, yeah. And and they are just, they didn't even finish, I don't think, either. So they had an issue on track, I believe. Might have been mechanical. Oh, no, it might have been mechanical. So they didn't even finish either. So that's 2 races in a row that we don't have a finishing ESM Nissan. What a low coming from the high of Sebring.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, it's, and then finally, just looking at some of our notes here. So just to go over again with Wayne Taylor Racing, they're going to get a win, right? We're saying everybody's going to get a win for the rest of this year, right? But I feel like Wayne Taylor are like right there. Renger van de Zande is putting in some great stints. Jordan Taylor is doing work, but they just don't seem to have the overall pace at the end of these races. I just feel one of these, Road America, Mazda maybe, they're going to snag one of these wins, I think.
I think, I don't know, to me it's like 50-50 whether they'll manage to do it, especially now with like the rise of the LMP2s, I guess you could call it. I mean, they've definitely, like here and at Watkins Glen, they were pretty prime, remember? They finished well at Watkins Glen too, I think, right?
Yes.
Like in the top, yeah.
Yeah, I think they were holding the lead up until after the, when the green flag came out after the last caution, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's this such a tighter field this year. I'm not sure if they can pull it off, honestly, but it would be great to see them get at least one win. But so, I mean, like a lot of the tracks that they're strong at have already passed them, I feel like a lot of the road courses.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah. A
lot of street courses.
Yeah, the street circuits that I think the Cadillacs definitely excel at. And I think you were right, though, too. I mean, the rise of the P2s has really, you know, stunted the Wayne Taylor potential. Because they had the opportunity to win at Watkins Glen, whether or not they would have with... That would have been a great battle, regardless of the 99 overtaking two of them, I feel like. Having Juan Montoya and Jordan Taylor kind of going side by side on the bus stop for the lead with the 99 behind him would have been maybe a half a lap of just great racing. And who knows, Jordan might have bumped wheels, something like that, made contact and carried over for the win if that 99 wasn't there. And then obviously last weekend with the 54 just driving by, barely... before that caution coming out, but I still think having the ability to pass that 10 again before the checkered flag, they're just not there. And so I feel like those might have been their best opportunities to win, but we've seen them have pace at Laguna, and we've absolutely seen them have pace at Road America. So those are good opportunities for them. But yeah, I think you're right, though, too, is that they might not end up winning this year, and I think that would be a shame and a missed opportunity, and what a turn of luck, or at least turn of fortune for that team from last year to this year.
Yeah, although I think they have sharpened up a little bit compared to the beginning of the season here in Watkins Glen. Because I remember this interview with Wayne Taylor where he said that they were benchmarking the Action Express cars because they're the other Cadillac cars as far as pace. And at the beginning of the season, like at Sebring and, well, I mean, at Daytona, they had the tire popping, so you can't really compare there. But earlier on, they were kind of behind. They had kind of fallen a rung below Action Express, it seemed like. But now they're right up there with them again as far as pace and track position and everything. I mean, here at CTMP, they finished right above Action Express. So I suppose by Wayne Taylor's metrics, they're where they need to be now.
I can't go wrong with that assessment either, Alex, to be honest. No, that, I mean, that sounds pretty, I think that sounds pretty accurate to what's going on right now. And I just think that, there will be opportunity for them to win. And I just feel like, they put themselves in a good position to do that so far this year. So, I would really like to see them win. And, I think AXR though, too, they've done a sterling job with both of those outfits. And I think, for the last 2 years, Cadillac's been a great and has been one of the class of the DPI field. And I mean, in terms of just an overall setup, performance standpoint, if it's not a P2 winning, if it's not ESM winning, if it's not Penske winning, it's a Cadillac. Mm-hmm. I mean, Cadillac are just going to clean up whatever it is you're not going to take advantage of and be perfect with. So
yeah.
I think that's a lot of credit to them.
Yeah, I don't think it's debatable that Cadillac is the strongest DPI, at least looking over all 3 or 2 years of DPI competition.
Yeah. Oh, no question. GTLM, though, meh, is what we have on our notes. And I kind of agree with that. The 67 takes the win. I really more or less on some lucky strat calls based on the full course yellows. With the two Corvettes kind of coming behind that, that would have been a great 1-2 victory for them had that 67 not spoiled the plans.
Right.
67 with a minus a quarter panel, right? I think it was a left rear quarter panel was missing on that car, so...
Oh, did they?
I think so. I think that was the one that was missing the rear end of that, or part of the rear end of that. So that was kind of funky looking. But yeah, I think so. Another Ford win. It's not the same. It's a sister car from the one that won it in the Watkins Glen round. But another kind of whoops, we lucked into this win with some strategy, okay. Some good fuel economy, and all that other stuff. Kind of classic GTLM winning explanations, right?
Right. The other thing though is the Porsche would have finished second in class, but they got caught up in some traffic and the two Corvettes just kind of like passed by it in formation.
They got
stuck behind like a Lexus or something.
Yeah, no, they got caught. He got caught up in retaliation because I think he had kind of forced his way down to Moss Corner on the left side and kind of made a little bit of a forceful move on it. And yeah, I think the Lexus was still on the inside or something like that and touched him coming out of Moss and definitely upset the car enough for that he didn't get any traction and was almost passed by that Lexus. And then you just saw like you said, you saw the Corvettes just sailing by on the right side. So, yeah, some unfortunate mismanagement with traffic. Yeah. And I don't know if it was repay or if it was just bad eyesight by the Lexus, but there was definitely some contact with the leader or for the second place runner, and he got screwed, unfortunately, by that, but...
Okay. I didn't realize that. I thought I was just, like, misreading the traffic in front and getting stuck behind a DTD.
It could have been one of those instances. There was, in the Prototype Challenge race, that a couple of the Mazda PCs really just got super squirrely, pretty much even before the Apex, and got loose. So that might have been the same thing that happened with the RSR, but... From the way that it looked, he kind of was a little forced with the Lexus when he overtook him and was in a spot where the Lexus was either on the inside or was right on his ass and could have... And it looked like he got tapped. So that's what I'm thinking happened. And you saw the Lexus then pull back on the right side, which GTD ain't supposed to pass a GTLM, especially on the corner exit. Corner exit of Moss, too, which is super bumpy. So you got to think that the Porsche got smacked a little bit there. So, hey, Rubin's racing, right? So, and it gave us some extra oomph there at the end. And Patrick Pilet finishing fourth in class. So yeah, like I said, the number 67 finishes P1. The 3 and 4 finished information behind in second, third, followed by the 911 in P4, with that sister car, 4GT, 66, finishing P5. We had another, and again, BMW finishing at the tail end of the class with a car that is out. Yes, that ended up going out, I think, with mechanical problems as well. Mm-hmm. So still struggles with BMW. They really haven't done a whole lot outside of be competitive at Sebring and really where? Mid-Ohio, I think they're slightly competitive there. They haven't done anything. I mean, GTE Pro has been way more competitive for them than here. I'm not sure what the deal is at this point, unless it's just the caliber of the team that is prepping these cars. But
yeah,
I mean, if the BOP is supposed to be somewhat similar between both of these, or that they're trying to be somewhat similar, I'm just not sure where the pace is for the BMW and GTLM.
Yeah. I remember at Daytona, they were really far behind, and I was like, oh, it's their first race. They still have to, like, get comfortable with the car, and the BOP will fix it. And then at Sebring, they got, like, two or three different separate, like, increases and boosts between Daytona and Sebring, and then they were like P2 and like up there the whole time, I think. So I was like, okay, cool. Like, BMW is like in it now. Like, they figured it out, and now they're gonna like fight with like Porsche and Corvette and Ford for the rest of the season. And then that just didn't happen.
I wonder if it's a balance thing. I just, like, you know, it's so hard as a guessing game from pace standpoint's concerned to just go, oh, well, it's a balance thing. Cause I mean, balance could be anything. I mean, I feel like that's such a nondescript term, because you a lot of times we go like, oh, well, he just needs more horsepower. Oh, he needs more downforce. And it's like, it's something quantifiable that you're like, okay, I get it. More wing equal more downforce, you know, more drag, but more grip. Whereas, right, like, balance is so difficult to even explain, especially in a BOP setting where you're designing the car to be as neutral as humanly possible with the largest amount, well, maybe not largest amount, but like the narrowest gap of, you know, comfort between all the drivers, where you can just go, okay, my comfort level is here, we only need to do a slight adjustment to make it comfortable for this driver, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And the aspect of trying to get that set up can be pretty difficult and daunting to do, but you could also then excuse all of the other reasons that you can list as to why these guys aren't doing well. And so that's why it's for people like me, I don't want to say that, like, the car is bad, BOP is bad yet, or whatnot. It does take a decent amount of time to figure this out in terms of how this car works, especially a GT car. I just don't feel like you can ever go into a category, unless it's a brand new category, and go, hey, look, we're going to wipe the floor with you guys, because especially in a BOP, and we're supposed to have this, you know, perfect setup in a sense, and it's just so hard to get there. And I don't think it's the car size. I don't think it's the car makeup. I don't think it has anything to do with any of that. It's the same thing with the Aston Martin team. They're out in left field and have no idea at this stage, on how to get back outside of just doing more testing and figuring out more of the actual strengths of that car outside of its weaknesses. So hopefully we'll see the BMWs do better. But, I mean, they're going to still be here next year, and I expect them to be way better next year regardless. So they're going to figure something out.
The thing about it that confuses me is that it should be like an evolutionary thing going from, I mean, obviously I'm not privy to like the engineering details of each car, but I would think that going from like the M6 to the M8, right, it's like a similar engine, it's like a similar size car, and it just seemed like it should be like a little bit more plug and play than it is, especially with how experienced in motorsports BMW is.
Well, remember that big excuse that they said with the M6 was that was for the unification rules that they assumed were going to come from GT3 and GTE. Like, they assumed the unification rules were going to come by, so they designed a car that would basically fit between GTE and GT3 pretty easily, which then, quote unquote, upset their overall global aspects of what they wanted to do with that car, because they compromised it from a design aspect. They didn't design it as a GTE car. They designed it as a GTE / GT3 car. So that was the main excuse. Right. Yeah. So that's why they didn't do a GTE Pro. That's why, you know, so all this stuff. So now when they're like, okay, here's basically an identical car that's even slightly bigger, but this is now completely designed for GTE and it's supposed to win GTE, you're going, okay, so then I mean, you guys were winning races in GTLM with a car that wasn't designed to win those kind of races. You guys should be at least showing some, you know, competitive aspect, especially after complaining after the first damn race. Like, you know, that's why it's like it's not adding up too much right now. I'm not too worried about it, but it definitely is like, all right, guys, what, like, stop barking if you can't bite is kind of my deal with that. So we will see. Road America, I hope they show some pace there. That would be nice to see. That's a long course. It's very unique. And for some reason, I think the 911s will do well there. But hopefully, hopefully we'll see the BMWs. GTD. So, man, that was a... after all of the stuff that I was talking about, especially leading up into this, if you couldn't tell, I was trying to segue slightly into this from the GTD talk about Riley. The 33 takes the GTD win for the overall, or for the class for GTD. Number three, Mercedes AMG, the team Riley taking that win, followed by the Lexus, number 14. And then Andy Lally and Magnus Racing in that Audi R8 taking P3, rounding out the podium. That is a welcome sight.
Yeah, it's a name we haven't heard in a long time.
Man, when's the last time that they podiumed even? Last year?
I mean, Lally probably podiumed last year.
Yeah, I think...
Magnus, I don't know.
They have a Rolex 24 win, I think. Not last year, but the year before that. And I think they might have won Sebring 2 recently, maybe 2 years ago or something like that too. So... But it's been a while, and I love this team. It's they're such a homely team, and a bunch of comedians that they could probably moonlight in a comedy club for a bit. But
yeah, easily.
Oh yeah, so it's great to see them finishing high, because they just, like I said, have not been anywhere in any relevance with the finishing orders. So, but to extend kind of beyond the podium to get into the championship talk. The 48 finishes P4, the Paul Miller racing Lamborghini, with the 86 and the 93 finishing behind them in P5, P6, with Catherine Legg finishing above Lawson Ackerbach in the Acuras.
So another really tight result for the championship, with the two leaders finishing right next to each other.
With Jack Hawksworth then finishing P7. So again, it's basically, we got a Lamborghini fighting out between two Acuras and two Lexuses, realistically, in terms of each of these races, with Lambo, Lexus, and Acura really all being represented at the championship fight. And then, again, Mercedes sneaking in there in a good win to finally see with the with Riley this year as well. So
yeah, with the number 33.
Yep, with the number 33. So a relative... I mean, I wouldn't say that the battles were terrible or non-existent, but it definitely, you know, there was a lot of talk about... I wouldn't say the talk was about necessarily the racing, but there was definitely a lot of spins that were going on in this. There was a lot of kind of notable issues going on throughout the bottom part of the field, specifically with Wright Motorsports and their GTD cars. Specifically, too, the 58 having issues with the 16, in which the 58 got punted and I think lost the lap due to getting punted by the sister car. So... some really unfortunate weekends for some of the GTD members, including the NEC or the Watkins Glen winners, the BMW Turner Motorsports crew, the 96. I think they had a mechanical issue and then also did not finish that race. So, yeah, it's some highs and lows even from a week to two, you know, beyond that. So really unfortunate for those guys, but it keeps the championship super, super close from everybody in their finishing positions. So, I don't know. Those are my points. Anything you got from this GTD battle at MO Sport?
I definitely say the GTD championship still feels pretty up in the air right now. So it'll be really interesting to see how the rest of the season goes. Like it is, right? Like Riley won it at this last race, so they might be on an upswing now. It's still super tight between Michael Schenck and Catherine Legg and the Paul Miller Lamborghini. So I feel like it's still at the point where like one race could still have drastic impact on the championship.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've got VIR, which is going to be an all GT affair. So the mm-hmm. racing will be extremely kind of intimate between those drivers. They're going to be just seeing a lot of them, you know, throughout the entire race and having to race against them and not have to worry about traffic. It'll just be really kind of hunkering down and going for, you know, your rivals essentially at there. And then we've got some pretty technical courses coming up to finish out the season. So, yeah, I mean, it's going to be extremely close for the rest of the year. I mean, if just the first eight rounds have had anything to go by, mm-hmm. and it will, you cannot make a mistake. Well,
there's like no allowance for any DNF or any like spin even.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, and looking, so I'm just pulling this up right now. I'm just want to look at where we're at, with some of the championships here that we've got going on. Wanted to go over GTD after round seven. Looks like after CTMP, 48 Paul Miller Racing is on ahead by 3 points with 183 over the 86 Michael Meyer Shank Racing. I shouldn't say Michael Shank because they do mm-hmm. did that merger, but they are ahead by only 3 points. And then actually, I should say the Riley is in third and is only it is only 14 points back from Paul Miller Racing with 169 points. That's actually followed by the 63 and then the 15. So while Lexus has seemed to have the pace almost every single race, they're not anywhere right now super close to the championship. However, a few wins in the next couple of weeks can absolutely change that for them. So
yeah. And how many points do you get for winning it?
15, I believe. Sorry. 30. Sorry. That's for 30. Drivers. Yeah. 30 points for a round win.
Okay, so the top two are separated by 1/10 of the points that you get for a win.
Oh, I'm wrong again. 35, it looks like.
35, okay, well, still around 1/10.
35, yes, exactly. Yeah. Okay. So 35 for them. And you know what? We'll just try to actually grab everybody here. So then GTLM heading into VIR, the 67 is leading the 3 by 6 points with 181 over 175 for Chip Ganassi over Corvette Racing with a 66. 2 points behind the Corvette, 175 to 173 in third place. So it looks like it's going to be a Ford Corvette affair. Porsche are in fifth and sixth with 167 and 166 points respectively. So it can change again. BMW technically also are within a shot with 157, 144 points. So if there's an issue in which one of these can't finish, there's definitely a... looks like at least a 12 to 13 point spread change difference between them. So, you know, you could see some late pushes at the end of the year and some misfortune really throwing havoc into GTLM, even though, like I said, it's looking more like it's going to be in between the 67-3 and 66 for the overall GTLM championship honors. And then rounding everything out with Prototype, we've got the number 31 and number 5 AXR Cadillacs rounding at the top of the championship standings with 198 and 197 points respectively, with the third Cadillac number 10 rounding out the top three with 188 points. So Core is actually top four, is the first manufacturer that is not a Cadillac, and so it's basically leading the best of the rest category with 183 points. So they actually still are within a very good shot if they can keep this success up that they've had in the last couple of races. You could even say Cork should have won Watkins Glen potentially. They had the faster car. They could try to throw a wrench in some of these DPI championship points coming into the final home stretch of this championship.
Well, yeah, that'd be a crazy way to end the season for LMP2 to have a championship.
We were talking about splitting this class and how many DPI and team managers that that were represented for OEMs were saying we should split the class and then potentially having Core come in and just take the championship. It would be an unbelievable storyline. And I would love to see it just for the chaos. That would be ultimate chaos for sports car prototype fans. And I'm all for it. So, but yeah, it's all three championships are close. You know, one is separated by 1 point. So, the prototype category will be something to watch, especially the Cadillac teams are basically all competing against each other. For the championship, even though they really haven't won it, all of the races are at least shown up in them. So it'll be a really good opportunity to kind of see who's really looking for a championship, who's looking for some good storylines in each race, and who's just looking to set some better pace and get some consistency started. So, Yeah, I talked a lot. But, yeah, I would say these are really great rounds, and I don't think we need to split the P2 DPI category up yet. I think just more knowledge and just more understanding of this, just more patience, I think, is a little bit required. But I think this is a good spot that it's at. I think there's going to be more problems than it will fix by splitting these categories if that's the route they want to go with. And I think the last two rounds have showed us that we don't need to do that in order to have really good racing. And if you can figure out the BOP, you can absolutely figure out how to give your fans world-class racing.
Yeah, I think as a whole, across the whole class, the teams are happier now than they were maybe two races ago.
Right.
I don't think any of the DPI teams feel like I don't think they feel like slighted by this, but I think the LMP2 teams feel a little bit better about being in this class now.
Yeah, there's absolute evidence to back up, you know, and there's evidence for IMSA to back up. We go, hey, look, we've got three P2 winners now in the last 2 years. Granted, that's definitely not even close to 50-50. We're not looking for 50-50, but it's an NEC round win, which is huge. I think that is going a little bit under the radar in terms of just the caliber of win that they got. That's a good one. And I think that was one of the requirements that I had put at the beginning of the year. I think when we were talking about this, was that I think I wanted to see a P2 win an NEC round. I think that was the next big step that they needed to do. They won at Laguna Seca. They won at Mazda Raceway. They needed to win one of these staple rounds. And for them to win Watkins Glen is big, especially at the face of what United Autosports is saying all weekend before. They were, we're out of pace, don't have the pace, blah, blah, we don't even have chat. I think the last two rounds have eased a lot of fears, and I think that's good. Mm-hmm. Will it be will this be here to stay? I don't think so. I think DPIs will continue to dominate for the rest of the year. We might see a P2 win at Petite, and I would love to see that. And I hopefully will be there to see it in person, because I will be screaming my lungs off for P2s. So, man, I love me some international P2s. But this is turning out into a really great championship, and I think that might not have been able to be said 2 weeks ago. And I think you're right. I think this is taking a turn for the better. The next full participation event will be Road America, and that's coming up in, I believe, 3 weeks from this recording. So probably about 2 weeks when we actually post this. That'll be August, I think, 4th or 5th or 6th or 7th, something like that. And that'll be up at Road America, Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin. My favorite track, my home track for where I live. So, and I will try to be making it up there. Hopefully we'll have some more information kind of coming out for that if needed. But, this was a solid couple rounds and I, in a breath of fresh air, Alex, any closing remarks for these two rounds for you?
Not really. Just stay tuned to the rest of the season and I'm sure it'll be a good one.
Yeah, we'll see. Now, is United Autosports going to be at Petite? I think they said they were committed to all the NEC rounds, correct? So we'll see them at Petite as well. Okay.
Yeah, I believe they're in NAEC with at least one car for the whole NAEC.
And I don't think, Rebellion wasn't in here this year. There was a couple other ones that might have participated. JCDC was, I don't think, was going to be doing Petite, right? Or were they? No, because of the clash, maybe, I think that was a problem. So, but anyway,
that's the Fuji, right, that they clashed with?
Yeah, I think that was the reason why they might not do that or one of the excuses. But beyond that, that'll be an action-packed round. That's our final round coming up for the IMSA Championship. That's going to be in the middle of October for Petit Le Mans. It's our final round in NAEC. So Watkins Glen was our third round. Fourth round is going to be that one. So much to look forward to. We got four more rounds of this championship for the GT cars, three more rounds for Prototype. We hope to have you listen to the rest of these as we recap and cover the rest of the championship and look forward to crowning hopefully a new champion come up at Petit Le Mans. So pleasure to have you guys listen to this podcast, and we'll talk to you guys later. Have a good night.
Yes, thanks. Stay tuned. See ya.
Gazoo!
You can really does them,
I always do them. For no apparent reason, I just scream them. So then it just became a thing that we just do.